Hi, this is Mike Bolton, and welcome to this edition of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. For the past several years, the Opera has engaged in its American Repertoire Program, a much-lauded initiative to present one new American work every season for a decade. The program has offered a series of memorable co-commissions, but this June, the company presents its first world premiere in the series, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, by composer Daniel Schneider and librettist Bridget A. Wimberly. The opera, written specifically for the unique talents of American tenor Lawrence Brownlee, will be seen in five performances at the Perelman Theater in the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, opening June 5th. The piece centers on what could have been, examined in the time between Parker's death, alone in the Stanhope Hotel on March 12, 1955, until his body was eventually identified at the New York City morgue. In this twilight between life and death, Parker composes his final masterpiece, revisiting the inspirations, demons, and women who fueled his creative genius. In this episode of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia, we'll learn more about the historical Charlie Parker and speak with members of the artistic team and cast about creating this spectacular new work. Charles Parker Jr., the only child of Charles and Addie Parker, was born on August 29, 1920, in Kansas City, Kansas. He would become one of the greatest jazz musicians in history, change the sound of jazz in the 1940s, and influence every single jazz musician who followed. He was known by his nickname, Yardbird, or the shortened version, Bird. The story goes that he was called Yardbird because he was either free as a bird or because he accidentally hit a chicken, known as a yardbird, while driving on tour with his band. His family moved to Kansas City, Missouri, where musical life, especially jazz, blues, and gospel, flourished. Like many successful musicians, he showed a great interest in music and ultimately fell in love with the alto saxophone. Soon, Parker was playing with local bands until 1935, when he dropped out of high school at the age of 15 to pursue a music career. He dedicated time to his craft, practicing in isolation, running through every tune in every key. Parker, in a 1954 radio interview with the jazz musician Paul Desmond, confessed that, quote, "The neighbors threatened to ask my mother to move. She said I was driving them crazy with the horn. I used to put in at least 11 to 15 hours a day, and I did that for a period of 3 to 4 years. From 1935 to 1939, Parker worked in Kansas City with several local jazz and blues bands from which he developed his art. By 1938, Parker joined pianist Jay McShann's band, touring Chicago and New York and performing solos on several recordings. He eventually caught the attention of other rising jazz musicians, like Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk. Scholar and author Stanley Crouch recounts Parker's breakthrough performance in his book Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. February 1942, the 21-year-old Parker is on the bandstand at Harlem's Savoy Ballroom, performing with the Jay McShann Orchestra for a live radio broadcast. He steps up to solo, and magic happens. When the band started throwing up riffs behind him, Parker sidestepped the familiar shapes, issuing his responses from deep in left field. Each chorus was getting hotter. It was clear from the position of his body and the sound of his horn that Charlie Parker was not going to give in. All the nights he had worked on it, the flubs, the fumblings, the sore lips, mouth and tongue, the cramped fingers, they all paid off that afternoon. Suddenly, the man with the headphones was signaling McShann, "Don't stop, don't stop, keep on playing." Parker's jazz style was called bebop, and everyone wanted to hear it. Working with Dizzy Gillespie, Parker formed a group in New York City and took the ensemble on the road, eventually bringing bebop to Hollywood for 6 weeks. As a teenager, Parker was hospitalized after a car accident, and during his recuperation, he developed an addiction to morphine and subsequently became addicted to heroin. Use of the drug was widespread in the jazz scene, and access to the euphoria-causing narcotic could be easily found. He resorted to busking, borrowing money from friends and fans, and even pawning his saxophones for drug money. But after the Hollywood engagement, most of the group returned to New York, and Parker stayed in the City of Angels and cashed in his return ticket to buy heroin. His time alone in California was particularly difficult, and he eventually committed himself to Camarillo State Mental Hospital for a 6-month period due to a nervous breakdown. Parker was discharged from the hospital with a clean bill of health and returned to New York. He made his Carnegie Hall debut in 1947, and his calendar was booked with high-profile engagements and equally high fees. His jazz ensemble included a mix of old friends like Dizzy Gillespie, among others, and a young trumpeter from St. Louis named Miles Davis. Things were going so well that a new jazz club in New York City on 52nd Street was dubbed Birdland in his honor. It would become one of the most legendary jazz clubs in America. His career was riding high, performing with the greatest artists like Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Bud Powell, Charles Mingus, and recording for the greatest jazz labels like Savoy, Dial, Verve, Mercury, Vogue, and EMI Columbia. If he was successful as an artist, his personal life was tumultuous. He married his childhood sweetheart, Rebecca, in 1936 when he was 16. Despite that the couple had 2 children, he would beg Rebecca to divorce him, to set him free so that he could pursue music unencumbered. He left his second wife, Geraldine Scott, only months after their marriage in 1943. And Parker married Doris Snyder in 1948, after his stay in the mental hospital in California. They separated, but never divorced, due to financial strain and his recurring substance abuse. By the 1950s, Parker was with jazz fan Chan Richardson. Although the two never married, she changed her name to Parker and had 2 children with him, a daughter, Pri, who only lived for 2 years, and a son, Baird, born a year and a day before Parker's death. In 1951, Parker was arrested for heroin possession and his cabaret card revoked, which meant he couldn't perform in New York clubs. When he got out of prison in 1952, his personal challenges virtually ruined his career, as many club owners refused to hire him. Depressed and strung out, he twice attempted suicide in 1954 by drinking iodine. He survived both attempts, but his mental and physical health was severely compromised. His final public performance was on March 5, 1955. A week later, he would be dead. Parker died on March 12th at the Stanhope Hotel in New York City, in the suite of his friend and jazz patroness, the Baroness Panonika de Königswarte, she of British-Hungarian descent and the youngest daughter of Charles Rothschild, the head of the wealthiest family in the world at the time. The official causes of death were lobar pneumonia and a bleeding ulcer, but Parker also had an advanced case of cirrhosis and had suffered a heart attack. The coroner who performed his autopsy mistakenly estimated Parker's 34-year-old body to be between 50 and 60 years of age. Librettist of Charlie Parker's Yardbird, Bridget A. Wimberly, shared this information with Opera Philadelphia. The facts about his untimely death and what happened to him postmortem created quite a media sensation and followed the Baroness for the rest of her life. These accusations included the deliberate misidentification of his body with the wrong name, an age on his toe, the amount of time it took to get his body to the morgue, about 5 hours, and why Nika did not tell anyone he had passed, allowing his body to lay unclaimed in the morgue for days. Because Nika was part of the Rothschild family, her actions were attributed to covering up the scandal of a black man dying in a wealthy, married white woman's hotel suite. Nika vehemently countered, stating she was only trying to help a sick friend get well and had immediately called the doctor when it appeared that he had passed. Charlie was taken to Bellevue's morgue with his correct name, and Nika said she wanted to find Chan to let her know about his death first, from a friendly source, before the newspapers or radio announced it. She searched all of New York, but Chan had moved to Pennsylvania. It wasn't until Nika was able to find and notify Chan's mother that she found out, adding a day or two more to Charlie's stay in the morgue. As soon as Chan claimed his body, however, Charlie's third wife, Doris, claimed him, because Charlie and Chan had not legally married. As they fought over his body and later his estate for decades, Nika was evicted from the Stanhope, a segregated hotel, and disinherited by her family. Her husband later divorced her and took custody of their youngest children. Charlie Parker's Yardbird takes a look at what might have happened in between Parker's death on March 12th and the time that his body was identified several days later at the morgue. Parker had been on a quest to learn more about music, including classical music. He approached classical conductor Günther Schuller as part of this quest. Not only was he intent on learning more about music, but wanting to explore and expand its possibilities. Charlie Parker's Yardbird examines that quest as well. Imagine having an opportunity to realize one final dream before you die. Charlie Parker often talked about writing new music for an orchestra of 40 or more. In the opera, as his body lies in the morgue, Charlie's ghost enters Birdland, the 500-seat club named after him. And his spirit, both surprised and inspired, now stands in this new Birdland. Here he will create his final masterpiece. He's interrupted by Nika, who appears frantically in search of his wife Chan, so she can tell her Charlie is dead. Charlie needs all the time available to write. Nika, on the other hand, needs Chan to claim Charlie's body and end the potential nightmare of the press announcing that he has died in her hotel suite, forcing the hotel to evict her. Charlie tries to write, but the notes will not stay on the paper. As a master of improvisation, Charlie long realized that the 12 semitones of the chromatic scale could lead melodically to any key, freeing musicians from the 12-bar blues. Needing a new freedom, Charlie is visited and inspired by people who have meant much in his life. With the inspiration of his strong mother, Adi, three of his four wives, Rebecca, Doris, and Chan, and his partner in the jazz revolution that was bebop, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie will struggle to calm his demons and write his new masterpiece before his body is identified in the morgue and this gig is up forever. Can he do it, or will the demons of his past rear their ugly heads? Will he succumb to heroin or alcohol, or is he just too tired and sick to go on? Will he channel the strength and love of his mother, a woman who worked long hours to give him everything she could? He was her only child. Did she mother him too much, or will he honor her with a new masterpiece? He left his first wife, Rebecca, with an infant son nearly 15 years earlier. Can she forgive him? Charlie will bravely revisit Camarillo State Mental Hospital, a purgatory, searching for inspiration and healing. Will he find it, and will he be able to forgive himself for the death of his daughter Pri, whom he could not save? Can her forgiveness save him? This opera searches for the music in dreams deferred and the power of redemption. And the opera proudly closes with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, the last stanza from Sympathy, a poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar, understanding and acknowledging both the struggle and triumph of Charlie Parker. Thank you. During workshops for the opera, we had the chance to talk to composer Daniel Schneider, librettist Bridget A. Wimberly, director Ron Daniels, and the cast of Charlie Parker's Yardbird about this opera. Tenor Lawrence Brownlee portrays Charlie Parker, soprano Angela Brown sings the role of Addie Parker, his mother, mezzo-soprano Tamara Mumford is the Baroness Panonika de Königswarte, or Nika, baritone Will Liverman is Dizzy Gillespie, soprano Rachel Sternberg is Chan Parker, his last wife, mezzo-soprano Crystal Williams is Charlie's first wife, Rebecca, and soprano Angela Mortellaro is Doris Parker, his third wife. Composer Daniel Schneider spoke about the opera score. Rather than using large portions of Parker's music or trying to write music for the saxophone in Parker's distinctive style, he turns Larry Brownlee's virtuosic voice into Charlie Parker's saxophone. The opera, in turn, also suggests what Parker's unfulfilled dream of writing a classical piece might have sounded like. Here's composer Daniel Schneider.
It's about Charlie Parker. It doesn't sound like Charlie Parker's music. And we were also thinking about a saxophone. You know, the saxophone will be on stage. Obviously, Larry is Brownlee. He's not going to play the saxophone, but it will be on stage. And then Corrado Ravaris came up with the idea that the saxophone has to be also represented in the orchestra as a sound. But it's always dangerous to mix these two things, because there's an original Charlie Parker, and if you try to imitate that, you run against the wall. It's not, because it's on an unbelievable level, and you can't duplicate that. What you can do is you can reflect it. And also, the whole opera is not about Charlie Parker's music, what he actually did, but what he might have done afterwards, because he was very interested in classical music. He wanted to study with Edgar Varèse, he wanted to study with Stravinsky, he wanted to go to Paris to study classical compositions. It was all in his brain, and he was a big fan of Feuerfogel by Stravinsky, Firebird, and knew that stuff by heart, studied the score. So that's just a direction that he wanted to go himself, but never had a chance to go there. So what I just want to build a little bit on that momentum, on this fantasy that what would happen if he would have actually written, you know, an opera. He never did that, and I've never had a chance, but or a symphonic piece, or a string quartet. How would that sound? And if you ask me whether they are little quotes, little snippets, yes, obviously, yes. And it's just of the heritage that needs to be reflected.
Longtime friends and colleagues Lawrence Brownlee and Angela Brown talked about studying together at Indiana University, working together again, the characters and the music of Charlie Parker's Yardbird.
You know, Larry and I go way back.
Not that long.
Well,
we're not that old.
But we do go way back. And
it's been almost 20 years.
Yeah, it's been a minute at yes. IU. We went to IU together.
Before IU, actually. The Stuart Awards.
That's true. We did the Stuart Awards. Yeah, we've had a wonderful time together.
Putting it all together with the different voices, I think the music bring out our strengths, and so that's been nice to hear. Of course, there's a lot of emotion in the music, in the characters, the relationship we have.
Yes.
As you being a very young mother to
I
Charlie
am a very
Parker.
Young mother to Charlie Parker.
But enjoying
you
that.
Know, I don't know why he keeps making the reference to age here. I'm the one that got in the bottle today. Uh-huh. But Charlie Parker was my only child, and I'm very possessive and loving to a fault, even though I wanted my child to do what he wanted to do with his life. I'm also scared. African Americans in America, we weren't very safe. And so there were things that he liked to do that would get him in trouble, okay? And I wanted him to come home at night. And he had an appetite.
Yes.
Yes. Would you like to talk about your appetite?
He wanted to see the world in different ways, and I think he wanted to live in the bright lights of New York. A lot of the great storied jazz musicians were in New York City, and the scene at that time, he wanted to get there. So any way he could, you'll find that out in this opera. The things he dealt with, everyone knows about his addictions, but the great influence that he had on the world of music, that people understand that they're going to get somewhat of an education on the history of jazz during that period of time and life in America for not just African Americans, but I think the world of music.
There's so many, many melodies that you hear that I think are very hummable and singable tunes. Now, because actually the process has reminded me of doing my first Porgy and Bess. You listen to all these wonderful tunes and you're sitting in the theater and it's like, oh, wonderful, happy day. Then when you get that score, you realize that Gershwin was no punk and neither is Mr. Daniel. He is putting us through our paces and I'm enjoying it a great deal. And it's full of emotion and passion. And I think it really tells a very succinct story of Charlie Parker's life.
Mezzo-soprano Tamara Mumford inaugurated Opera Philadelphia's Aurora series for chamber opera at the Perelman Theater in Britain's The Rape of Lucretia and returned for the U.S. premiere of Henze's Phaedra. How does she feel about coming to Philadelphia for special pieces like these, Charlie Parker's Yardbird, and creating the role of Nika?
What have I got to know about her? She is this fabulous woman. She's very important in jazz in that day because she was incredibly rich, left her family and her upbringing in England. She was a Rothschild and just left her husband and her five babies and came to get in on the jazz scene. And then she took care of all the jazz musicians. I mean, she was at the clubs and she was driving them around in her car and she had this great apartment where they would come and have jam sessions in her place. And she really just kind of became the, they called her the Baroness of jazz. So yeah, it's been really interesting to kind of get to know her. And of course her significance in the jazz era is important, but her significance in this opera is especially important because Charlie Parker died in her apartment, which was a huge scandal because, well, first of all, they were both married and why is he at her apartment in the first place? But that's one thing. But then she was, the Stan Hotel was segregated. So the fact that this man was in her apartment in the first place was a huge ordeal. And she talks about the whole story of, you know, when I left you, you were just here, you were happily watching TV. And as I've read the books, this is exactly what she has said has happened. You know, he was watching this kind of variety show, and then suddenly he was laughing, and then he was gone. And it's interesting because in some things I've been reading, it talks about how he came to her place. There was actually a quote by Thelonious Monk's son who said, you know, he came to Nika's apartment because there's nobody else in New York that would have taken him in because he, you know, had such a history with drug abuse and had kind of had just like swindled everybody around him. And so people didn't, you know, they didn't trust him. They didn't want him there. But she was just this woman that just loved jazz and would do anything for the art form, really. Just loved the people, loved to be part of it all. And she just kind of had this mission of just helping these people. In actuality, she wasn't incredibly close to Charlie Parker, but that moment was something that changed her life forever. Something that being part of a new work always just kind of fills me with, I don't know, this sort of hope that this art form is not dead. It's being premiered here, and that they can see that opera is very important, that we're telling wonderful stories and that we're making these connections through music and through a libretto. I think it's exciting that, especially here at Philadelphia, I think they are really committed to new works and allowing that to happen. And I think that's really, really great. I think I wish there was more of that.
Opera Philadelphia emerging artist Will Liverman talked about creating the role of Dizzy Gillespie.
I think it's just as much fun as when I first heard that I was gonna do the role. I mean, to create the role of Dizzy Gillespie, I mean, one of the greatest trumpet players, jazz trumpeters of all time. I mean, some would say that he's the greatest, one of the most imperative jazz musicians. I mean, you know, him and Charlie Parker, you know, these rising musicians coming up in the 1940s, you know, and clearly, you know, we're dealing with issues, racism is so blatant in the Jim Crow laws, and you know, they wanted to rebel against this racism in the streets and racism in the music industry. And you know, what came out of that was this new bebop era of music, you know, for music's sake, and this underground movement of, you know, what we know today as modern jazz. So it's really cool to, you know, play an opera about, you know, this jazz musician and all the great things that he's accomplished.
Collectively, we asked the artists, why should audiences see Charlie Parker's Yardbird?
I am a great appreciator of jazz and many styles of music, gospel, of course, classical, R&B, Latin music. So I think this opera has many elements of all those things. And Charlie Parker, a great important figure in the world of music, I think his music showed some of that. And I think people can see elements or traces of his music in many different genres. The strong element of jazz, but of course, the classical feel with it as well. And I think there's a merging of styles that work together. There's some wonderful melodic lines that I think people can leave the theater even humming these tunes because they are things that will stick. So some of the riffs that are, you know, associated with his, again, his virtuosity, you will hear elements of that in the opera. And so I think, again, this is an opera that people will be in the audience tapping their feet. And again, I think people can kind of maybe unbutton their collar and relax and enjoy the story and the music accompanying that, I think will be a great thing.
I hope they will feel that they've enjoyed something, that there has been yet another new opera that can be put into the repertoire that is relevant. It's today, even though the subject matter is about someone's life, it's telling a story and it's entertainment. I've always been of the impression that when it came to classical music or opera, the public in general look at it like it's medicine, you know, and that they shouldn't enjoy it or that they wouldn't enjoy it because it's called opera. Get over it, okay? It's entertainment. It's like going to a movie. It's like going to the ball game. It's another way to express yourself and just to have fun. So I hope that the public will come, learn something about the life of Charlie Parker, be inspired, be entertained.
As we end this podcast for Daniel Schneider and Bridget A. Wimberly's Charlie Parker's Yardbird, I encourage everyone to check out Opera Philadelphia's website at operaphila.org for more information on the opera, including video interviews with the creators and cast, background information on Charlie Parker and the opera, upcoming events, and more. The opera has 5 performances only from June 5th through the 14th in the Perelman Theater at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets can be purchased online at operaphila.org, and I hope you can join us for these world premiere performances. You can also turn to our website to learn about the company's 2015-2016 season, which includes productions of Andy, a Papera, a world premiere collaboration with the Bearded Ladies Cabaret Troupe, Verdi's La Traviata, the East Coast premiere of Jennifer Higdon's Cold Mountain, Strauss's Capriccio, and Donizetti's The Elixir of Love. You can do all that by visiting operaphila.org. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you're attending Charlie Parker's Yardbird, join me, Mike Bolton, for a free preview talk, Opera Overtures, 1 hour before every performance. If you have any questions about this podcast, please email me at outreach@operaphila.org. This is Mike Bolton, and thanks again for listening to this podcast. I hope to see you at the opera.